papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Media Project gives you a half hour of commentary and analysis, some insight into newsroom decision-making, we think, in the digital age. I'm Rick Smith of the Upstate American, formerly editor of the Times Union. I am your host here for now, and we are talking to our colleagues. We have here the Vice President of the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette.
Good day.
Good day. We have Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record in Troy, now teaching at UAlbany.
Happy to be here.
Well, I'm glad that you're happy to be here. And Ira Fussfeld, retired as publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston and its affiliated publications.
Hello, Rex. Good to be back.
Well, back. I mean, you were briefly gone, I suppose.
Well, no, it's just I have a bad back.
Oh, it's good to be good to be back and all that. Hey, there is a British invasion of American newsrooms, but we'll get to that point. The initial factor leading to that is the departure, the abrupt departure of the editor of the Washington Post. Now, why does this matter to our listeners? Because it signifies pressures still going on, even in the most storied newsrooms in America. So just to leave the background here, Sally Busby, who was hired just 3 years ago from the Associated Press, where she was the executive editor to run the Washington Post, has suddenly left with some questions about why. The publisher went into the newsroom and said, the problem is we lost $77 million last year and people are not reading your stuff. I can't sugarcoat it anymore. What do we make of that?
Well, as a publisher, that resonates with me, although the numbers are certainly a lot different. But I believe that the criticism is fair and the criticism is realistic. And there comes a point in time where the publisher's got to say, we got to make some big changes here because we can't keep doing what we're doing. So I would applaud if in fact, Sally Busby left because of that direction that he's trying to take the paper and he had a plan, he has a plan, you know, fine, we'll do it without you. But it's certainly within his right to make those changes.
Man, you sound like a publisher.
Yeah, good. I haven't completely lost it. Yeah.
You know, there was this post-Trump decline in news consumption. I mean, that's undeniable. Every news organization has felt it. The cable news networks have felt it as well. I think the New York Times has been able to do well despite that by branching off into games and charging for, you know, cooking and athletic subscriptions as well. I think to lay the blame at the foot of the news operation is wrong. And also, he ended his conversation by wrapping up with his penultimate point, and then he explained it to a group of wordsmiths that penultimate meant second to last, insulting them all in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the plot thickened a bit about why Sally Busby left, but on the publisher's responsibility, the owner's responsibility, of course, they need to be looking at ways to improve the financial situation, and the place to look has got to be in the newsroom. The key is for the owners to never lose sight of the mission. Why do you exist? What are you supposed to be doing? Who are you supposed to be serving? And there's some questions in the validity of what they were coming up with or supposedly coming up with as a plan to address the need to increase readership. And I think they were planning to separate out a segment of what was currently a news and opinion operation to add a third wing that was going to be devoted to social media and kind of like service projects, which sounded not that realistic to me. I didn't understand why under the umbrella of news exists public service, all the things that should be covered.
Service journalism, I think, being like food and things like New York Times Wirecutter. I think that's what they mean by service journalism.
They're talking about being more like the New York Times, which has been able to supplement its revenue by
not performing community service,
right,
but just other services.
It is interesting that there is some reporting that suggests, reporting by the New York Times, by the way, which scooped the Washington Post on its own editor's departure, And then subsequent reporting by the Times is that the publisher and the editor had had a confrontation some weeks ago about a story in which the publisher, a guy whose name is Lewis, his name is Will Lewis. He was previously a British newspaper executive. And in that capacity, there was some question about his involvement in the phone hacking scandal that fully engrossed Rupert Murdoch's newsrooms in Britain.
Although he has denied involvement in it, so let's be careful about that. Here we go in the media, naming somebody who was tied to something which gives the impression that there is guilt there, which has not been determined. I think the key issue that ties into all of this is what he wanted Sally Busby to do about that upcoming report that could involve his name. And his supposedly he was saying, hey, that's not news. We're not going to need to cover that. That's not really news. That is super troubling.
Yeah, Ira, should publishers be doing that?
I was just going to say, now, this is an instance where the publisher in me is not eager to defend this publisher if, in fact, the story that the New York Times ran is accurate. He should understand, and I'm sure he does, if he is, in fact, chosen to try to put a blanket over his potential involvement. That's not the sort of thing that generates confidence from readers and advertisers in the quality of your report. So, no, I don't defend that. But I do go back to, if they're losing $77 million over whatever period of time it is, and they don't do anything different. Even Jeff Bezos, who owns the company, has got a lot more than $77 million, doesn't want to burn that money up. You've got to try to fix it. And this is the way he thinks it should be fixed, then go to it. Is he right? I'm not sure I think that this is the best route for the Washington Post, but I'm not in the Washington Post every day of the week or at all. So.
But you have to try something. Doing nothing doesn't improve your situation.
Yeah, I don't know. So they brought in this British team, essentially a British team. And the British media, I think, view the Washington Post as a stodgy old lady. And they are going to add some British-style journalism to what the Washington Post does. Do I think that's a good idea? I don't want American newspapers to become like the British tabloids.
I think that's a very good point. And I think that is the great concern, because now not only do you have Mr. Lewis, who was previously, by the way, the chief executive of Dow Jones, which publishes the Wall Street Journal. You have not only him, but you've got the president of CNN, that is the CEO of CNN, Mark Thompson, who was previously the president of the New York Times. And there's a third one, too, who's come over from the UK.
The Daily Beast.
The Daily Beast.
Well, we were concerned when we discussed it numerous times on this program about what the impact on the Wall Street Journal would be when Murdoch purchased it. And I think we have largely not seen what we feared we were going to see with the Wall Street Journal. And if we can extend that to the Brits taking over the Washington Post, they're not going to make it the New York Post unless they're absolutely last resort, because they understand what that newspaper's place is in national and world journalism. So I don't think that that's a fear that should be.
I appreciate your confidence in them, but the fact that this guy wanted to squelch his name from a story.
Well, that's troubling.
If that's true.
And did he get published ultimately?
Yeah, it did get published, right? She resisted. Would the new guy who he's bringing in from the UK, where he's been an editor of The Telegraph, will he resist? And we don't know what the Wall Street Journal hasn't published. Maybe there was more stuff that has gone under the surface during his leadership of Dow Jones than we're aware of. But of course, what undergirds all of this is the financial insecurity of the media still. The fact is, he's making the point that the Washington Post has lost 50% of its audience since 2020. Now, that's an astonishing notion, to lose half your audience just in the last 4 years. Terrifying.
But I think Judy addressed that once he had what we thought was a normal and long-lasting change in leadership in the White House. There wasn't the panic and the compulsion to stay on top of the news as much.
And part of it also is, at the time, the Washington Post was being very aggressive in offering, you know, penny subscriptions. And when you do something like that, you will get some attrition when the penny subscription turns into a $5 a week.
Well, we also don't know what the impact of the pandemic was. There are a number of factors.
All true. But what do you do? I mean, I'm grateful to no longer be running a news organization, frankly, because the
me
pressures.
As well.
Yeah.
Yes, I second that, both on your case and mine.
Because it's so difficult now. It's almost as though you try everything. And the drive to get more ad revenue, or in public radio, it's referred to as underwriting. But I was looking at a news story I really wanted to read with photographs I really wanted to see on my handheld device here on a prominent local news site, and I couldn't get the damn ad to reveal the photograph. Yeah. Doesn't it just drive you crazy, the pop-ups?
How dare they want to get paid for their coverage?
Well, well, I think in some ways we're killing ourselves with those ads that make reading so frustrating that you give up. You walk away, you're going to go find that news story some other way. And I would advise restraint. Maybe I can take one pop-up ad. If you're going to give me three in a row and I keep having to look for the silly X to
hit it. Right, that's what I think what they need to find is a way for people to pay by the story if they're not already subscribers. And if you are a subscriber, for Pete's sake, don't make us suffer through the ads that are hidden.
You know, I think the Washington Post probably has a pretty healthy newsroom budget, and we all have made economies, and then maybe they expanded their newsroom way too much, and maybe they need to pull back a little bit.
Spoken like a manager.
We've all been there. The number of times that you have to cut your staff and you say, well, okay, we can get by without this and without this and without this. And eventually you look around and there's nobody else in the newsroom.
And the readers miss it. One of the joys and aggravations of a daily newspaper is it's an all-encompassing publication that has all sorts of subject matter in it. The example that I think most of us always use is the bridge column. And if you're trying to save a few bucks, particularly at a small paper where the bridge column rate may well be an impactful one, and you'd consider dropping the bridge column, you say to yourself, you won't hear anything about that. Well, then sure enough, you haven't seen the mail the next day after you've dropped it. Point being, it doesn't take much to lose circulation if somebody is buying your newspaper for only one or two items as opposed to the news product in general.
It's a slippery slope, and at the top of the slippery slope is the bridge column.
I tell this story shortly after I became the publisher of the paper. I was in the office on a Saturday, and there was nobody else in the building. And I looked out the window because I heard a car pull up outside my window. And I said, oh, and they went to the rack, the box in front of the paper, to buy the newspaper. And I said, oh, isn't this great? And I watched because they were thumbing through it. And I wanted to see what they stopped at. And did they stop at the great news stories or the sports box scores? No, they went to the classified section.
Oh.
And as an ex-news guy, I would never think, oh, I'm not just going to buy the paper to go to classified, but that's important.
Not anymore.
There's not much there.
Yeah. Oh, it's a heartbreak. Folks, if you have thoughts about this, media@wamc.org is our email. We'd be happy to hear from you. media@wamc.org. I'm Rex Smith here with Judy Patrick, Barbara Lombardo, and Ira Fussfeld.
May I mention one nitpick in the New York Times story, something that drives me crazy, and I'd love to hear from our listeners if things like this drive them crazy, but the adjective embattled.
Embattled.
Embattled. You know, politicians are embattled, and in this particular story about Sally Busby, they call her the embattled executive editor, and I, as a journalism teacher and as an editor and a writer, I detest these cliche terms. Mm. I don't know what else I would have called her, but maybe the adjective was not needed.
Maybe it was. Maybe you describe instead of using an adjective. Give people the reporting to undergird what that word was supposed to shorthand.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, and this challenge between revenue and what's called UX, the user experience, is a real one. And finding the appropriate UX solution that's not going to cost you so much that you can't deliver the product digitally or that you're not giving people what they need. We do know that people have been inured to the news and folks are just not paying attention to it as much. So the fact is we're all scrambling. CNN has a new strategy asking readers to submit personal data, like their email addresses, if they want to get stuff for free. So they're trying to get data that they can market. And the Wall Street Journal, they have a new brand advertising campaign. So they're all over the place. There is a focus on consumer revenue to make up for the loss of advertising revenue, since all the advertising is going to the giant digital media sites. And that just means that there is more pressure on the folks trying to sell the product and more stuff interfering with the user experience. Going back to that. There we are.
That felt so creepy and sleazy about when I read about CNN requesting your data. Just, yeah. I don't want to do that.
What can you do? Okay, let's, speaking of a scandal in the media, that was not it actually, that was just business, but there is scandal in the media. That is one of the biggest media boosters of Donald Trump is just in serious legal jeopardy. It's called the Epoch Times, E-P-O-C-H. Now, if you're not familiar with the Epoch Times, maybe you haven't been noticing all the advertising, which it has been staging in recent years. This was a paper that was formed a few years ago to combat the Chinese Communist Party, two decades back. But the Epoch Times in this digital era, it's become not just a right-wing newspaper, it is a major digital presence supporting the MAGA movement. Turns out now that the chief financial officer has supposedly been at the helm of a $67 million money laundering scheme. The reason that I bring it up is just because it does seem to raise questions about the validity, the trustworthiness of non-brand name news organizations. Am I just an old bogey?
Well, there are a lot of bad actors, and it's shocking to say there are even bad actors in the media. And this one is of interest to me, not because of what is alleged, because that doesn't particularly shock me. It is that it's been, as you point out, a far-right publication that what it is alleged to have done presumably would not be approved by its readership. And I don't know yet if it's too early to determine whether the pins have been knocked out from under it or if it's going to somehow survive this, as so many right-wing figures seem to be able to do when they're charged or convicted.
Well, it's still up and fully operating as of my last check.
Yeah.
One of the issues is there are so many of these news organizations that have sprung up overnight. There are hundreds of organizations that use AI to quickly generate stories that are typically meaningless but are generating traffic nonetheless. I don't even think you could put together a directory of all the media organizations that are out there. And that raises the issue of, you know, what really is a media organization and what isn't? Who's really abiding by journalistic ethics? Who's serving a community? The lines have faded so much it's hard to tell which is which.
And the difficulty is that people tend to trust what affirms their own biases, right? We like to read or hear or view what we believe to be true based upon the prejudices that we all have. And so many of those biases are being fed by people who don't have a commitment to the truth. They're being fed by the likes of Tucker Carlson, for example, and his own individual site. And they're being fed by the folks at Fox News and its imitators who are unabashed zealots. I shouldn't say unabashed. They don't claim to be. They claim to be telling the truth.
But it's also disconcerting when there are outlets like Epoch that can look pretty good. They're polished products. And once you actually are listening to what they're saying, you can see where they're coming from. But they seem believable.
Yeah. Maybe 15 years ago, I got a call from the editor of the Epoch Times at the time who said, could I bring a couple of people up to watch how your news operation works? Because they weren't familiar with how a newsroom functioned. And so they actually came up and spent the whole day with me, about seven of them. I went through our whole process, stayed even late into the night to watch the newspaper being put together. And it was at a time when the Epoch Times was really trying to gear up to prepare to be more like a serious news organization than just a PR organ for the Falun Gong, basically, which is how they were formed. And I'm sure that it's not the same person who's the editor now, but it was interesting to have these visitors who were putting out a paper who had no idea how to do it.
I would be careful, too, about mainstream media glee at what could be the fall of Epoch and its problems. It could happen in any organization from any political leaning, I suppose, to have somebody who's
if you're a financial officer, money laundering. That would be
a good thing to do. It could happen to others.
It could.
Is there a sense as to what its impact has been as an entity? Does it have a large readership?
It has a large digital presence, yeah. And you do see it in major cities. You actually see racks on the street still, which almost nobody else has anymore. And I think it's available in the Albany train station.
I got to get out more.
Yeah. It's the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. That's Ira Fussfeld, Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. Barbara, you said you were interested in talking about the question of the presidential debates and the issue involving RFK Jr. What's the issue there?
So if you're following it from a political point of view, the issue is whether RFK can and should be eligible to participate in the debates. But to me, the issue, for the purposes of this show in particular, the issue is how should the media be covering RFK, including this issue about whether he could or should be on the debate stage.
And Jill Stein and Cornel West as well.
This is a question. This country has turned into, and has been for a while, basically a two-party electoral system. And it's really the Electoral College that elects the president, so that having this tied to the Electoral College can be confusing to readers and listeners. But the onus is on the media to keep explaining what it takes to qualify to be in the debate according to CNN's rules, right? And whether we think it's a good idea or not, and what effect it has to have a third or fourth or fifth candidate getting that kind of national coverage.
And typically these third party candidates would travel through every small town, and every local newspaper would interview them. Ralph Nader, Jill Stein. Arash Perot, I think, was a different character. I think he rose to national prominence, and so he got the national coverage that a lot of candidates who are third party don't get. I think at this point in New York State, for example, we're covering whether or not RFK will actually get on the ballot. It becomes an issue. But I can remember when third party candidates would come through, how we would play their stories. We wouldn't play them on the front page. Typically, we would put those stories inside. Maybe that was a mistake, but that's how we handled it back then.
And we would also consider editorials. Should we be editorializing that the more the merrier, that everyone should have a voice, not just the two top candidates who haven't even gone through the official process of being
At the end of the day, that we journalists know that one of two people is going to be the president. It's either going to be Trump or it's going to be Biden. And if you have an event and a debate when the other one or more other candidates show up, all you wind up doing, other than elevating their candidacies, is take away time from the primary people who we should be listening to. So I think it's a difficult choice that we have to make, because we're becoming the Solomon here. We have to decide if we're going to split the baby or if we're just going to put the baby aside. But that's why they pay us the big bucks. I mean, this is why we have experience covering, reporting on, and opining on presidential elections.
Yeah, Nikki, I'm torn about whether we elevate RFK by putting him on the debate stage. I kind of think he doesn't belong there.
Can you briefly, excuse me, Rex, but can you briefly explain the CNN policy?
I think one of the, you have to have 15% of the,
in four specific polls.
You have to be getting at least 15%, and he's got three out of four so far.
And you have to be on enough ballots
around the country in the states that could add up to the total minimum number of electoral votes you would need.
270 electoral votes.
So that you're not just running and with no chance of winning.
He has now qualified on six states. His campaign says he's qualified for 11 other states, though not all of those.
Short of 270.
That's still short of 270, and not all of those states will necessarily certify him. Certainly won't have him certified in time for the June CNN debate. So he's saying the standards were unfair, and he's filed a complaint at the Federal Elections Commission.
Right. Our newspapers, I'm taking a leap of faith that our newspapers at various times while we were there all had debates or similar to debates. So we all had to make decisions like this as to include or not include. And that's just a decision you have to make.
What do you think? Would you include him or not?
Not based on what we know now about what his support is and what the likelihood is of him becoming president. I would be annoyed if I was a Kennedy supporter and I was excluded, but we have to be realistic about it. And we know that Trump or Biden are going to be the president. We want to hear from them.
There is a practical issue also that is frustrating, and that is the percentage of truth-telling by the candidates and the responsibility of journalists to try to set matters straight when candidates lie. And we know that Donald Trump is a continual liar.
An expert liar.
An expert liar, indeed. And frankly, so is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And I'm sorry to the listeners who disagree with that, but it is in fact true. And if you're going to have journalists at the debate stage constantly trying to set the record straight from the factual misstatements by these candidates.
That's limited to one liar. Not that he could take everything that Biden says to the
No, not saying that.
Goal.
He distorts facts, but
he's not an expert liar.
Yeah, he's much less capable at lying. Oh, dear.
Well, you know, he says these things that can be proven so easily to be not the case, such as him claiming he never said about Hillary, lock her up.
Yeah.
And they have all sorts of videotape of him saying exactly that any number of times.
This is a great thing about the media and its ability to take something that somebody claims and then to go back into the records. And that can be a time-consuming task to do that, but it's a blatant example, a pretty good example right now of how you can take what somebody's saying now and in their own words and actions show whether it's true or not.
Jon Stewart and The Daily Show are perfect on that.
Yeah, good work. Finally, just a quick answer, folks. How are the media handling the WNBA and the phenomenon of Caitlin Clark becoming a professional basketball player? Is this, I don't know, I'm just uncomfortable by all the attention that it didn't get before, I guess, right?
Well, I'm happy it's getting attention now. We can't go backwards.
The prevailing wisdom, and I'm not describing this belief to me, but the prevailing wisdom is that the WNBA has been composed heretofore of black players, LGBTQ players, and there was one other group that I would add to that, and that Caitlin Clark, the new phenomenon, is a new phenomenon not only because of her skills, but because she's white and she's straight. That was the other one. The number of the WNBA players were gay and thus would not qualify for the kind of coverage it is now getting because a white woman who has got a boyfriend.
I think it's all about money.
Well, that's right.
In many respects, it's about a antiquated, kind of a Neanderthal approach to covering sports, women's sports especially, that is finally being brought to light, and maybe we'll see some corrections being made.
On that point, we have to say that's all. That was Judy Patrick. Also, we had Barbara Lombardo, Ira Fussfeld, and I'm Rex Smith. With gratitude to our producer, David Gustina, for making this all happen, and to you folks for joining us this week. We hope to see you next week once again on The Media Project.
For romance, but finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian, and Daily Freeman publisher emeritus Ira Fussfeld. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Worries for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.